well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Larry Keene of the National Shooting Sports Foundation in just a moment. We've got a lot to talk about, starting with Chicago's lawsuit against Glock filed yesterday, accusing the gun maker of intentionally designing a product that can be readily converted into a machine gun and failing to make design changes that would make it difficult, if not impossible, to convert a semi-automatic pistol into a fully automatic pistol through the use of illegally obtained and used switches, right, which are becoming more and more common on American streets, according to law enforcement, including the ATF. Now, this is the latest step in something the gun control lobby has been doing for the past couple of years, which is, again, trying to make the case that virtually all semi-automatic firearms are readily converted to machine guns and therefore should be either banned or regulated under the National Firearms Act. This is a major step towards putting that policy in place administratively. In fact, it's interesting to note that John Feinblatt of Everytown said in a post on X announcing this lawsuit that the lawsuit was filed after the ATF had had conversations with Glock about changing the design of their product. Glock says it was impossible to do, according to Feinblatt, which raises the question, A, why does Feinblatt know about conversations between the ATF and Glock, unless the ATF is leaking that information to gun control groups like Everytown? And secondly, does this mean that the ATF is working on a rule of its own that would reclassify some or all semi-automatic firearms, pistols and long guns included, as quote unquote machine guns or readily converted to machine guns? Under which case, again, those arms would have to be registered under the National Firearms Act or potentially even banned outright. So we're going to talk about that with Larry Keene. We're also going to talk about the legislation signed in Indiana that will hopefully put a halt to a lawsuit that has been going on for nearly 25 years, filed during the Clinton administration by the city of Gary, Indiana, against major gun makers, accusing them, again, of intentionally allowing crimes to or guns to be diverted to criminals. It is a junk lawsuit that just refuses to die, but hopefully this bill will put the finishing touches on this lawsuit. And we'll also talk with Larry about what the NSSF is doing this election cycle to ensure that there are pro-2A representatives, not only in Congress, in the White House, but in the state legislatures and state capitals as well. Again, a busy conversation. Lots of stuff to talk about. Lots of ground to cover with Larry Keene. Let's get started. Take a look and a listen. Larry, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you today.
Always a pleasure. Spent time with you, Cam. How are you?
I am okay. I am a little disturbed by this lawsuit City of Chicago filed against Glock yesterday.
Yeah, it is. I've seen a lot of really frivolous, baseless lawsuits, but this one competes for the top of that list. It really does. It is so frivolous. It is breathtaking in its audacity. To suggest that a manufacturer, quote unquote, facilitated some criminal from illegally making, illegally importing, illegally possessing, and then illegally altering and modifying a perfectly legal, very popular, highly reliable semi-automatic pistol to illegally convert it to a machine gun is the responsibility of the manufacturer. They are somehow responsible. It's really ridiculous. And we've seen this now in other contexts where cities are suing car manufacturers like Hyundai, blaming them under these public nuisance lawsuits, saying that somehow the car manufacturer is responsible to the city for the cost of responding to stolen cars because they didn't make their car harder to steal. Like, every car comes with a lock. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And it gets even worse in the case Glock, because the head of Everytown has been bragging and tweeting about this lawsuit and has essentially admitted that, and I know this to be the case, that the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, which is staffed by the former top federal lobbyist for Everytown, Rob Wilcox, tried to muscle and pressure Glock into changing the design of their pistol, which is highly reliable, which is one of the most popular firearms being sold today, certainly one of the most popular pistols. And they have about 65% or more of the law enforcement market, including the city of Chicago Police Department, should change the design and make it less reliable, expose people to potential harm because the firearm didn't work when they needed it to because the design has been changed to make it less reliable, opening up Glock to product liability lawsuits. And how long, Cam, do you think it would take the criminals in China who are responsible for these illegal auto sears to modify the design of the auto sear in response to whatever change in design Glock might be able to come up with that, you know, made the pistol still function as reliably?
Right.
Which is, you know, an open proposition whether that can be done at all. How long do you think that would take? I would say a New York minute, but we're talking about Chicago, so let's call it. It's expensive. And it's very clear to me, and NSSF is going to call for a congressional investigation into the inappropriate actions of Rob Wilcox and the people in the White House who tried to muscle Glock, and then when they failed to do that, picked up the phone, called Everytown, and encouraged them to sue Glock because they didn't accede to the foolish wishes of Rob Wilcox and the White House to change the design of their perfectly functioning firearm. And also missing from any of the news coverage is the fact that Glock has been working very cooperatively with law enforcement, with Homeland Security, and going after people who are illegally importing the auto sears. So none of that's mentioned in the complaint.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, invokes the newly enacted Illinois public nuisance statute designed to circumvent and avoid the protection of lawful Commerce and Arms Act that NSSF is right now challenging in federal court in Illinois. So I suppose, and we will bring this to the attention of the court in our case, so I suppose I might have to send a thank you note to the mayor of Chicago for filing this lawsuit, because now there's no question about the fact that the industry and NSSF have standing to challenge that unconstitutional act.
Well, I'm glad to hear that this is going to be brought to the court's attention. I want to go back to something that you said, though, that you talk about Rob Wilcox with the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. You know, we recently talked with Peter Furcelli, former ATF agent. He has a memoir out about Fast and Furious. And I asked him his thoughts about Steve Dettelbach during our interview. And he said, you know, from what he hears, and he didn't want to name his sources because they're still, you know, active in ATF, but he said that basically Dettelbach is the yes man for Rob Wilcox, that Wilcox is the one who is sort of pulling the strings at the ATF as well. So did these discussions take place between the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention and Glock, or was it the ATF and Glock that had these conversations?
My understanding is it was directly between the White House Office for Advancement of infringing upon the Second Amendment, let's call it what it is.
Yeah.
And Glock. And and I've heard rumors that ATF tried to have a meeting with Glock about this very same topic. But, you know, I know that the conversation took place between Glock and the White House, and that Glock explained to the White House all of the things they are doing to cooperate with law enforcement, by the way, none of which they're legally obligated to do, but that they are not going and can't change the design of their pistol, and that it would be pointless to do that because the bad guys would simply redesign the illegal auto sear. So again, this administration is attacking the industry instead of going after the criminals, instead of applauding and thanking Glock for its cooperation with law enforcement to try to stop this, including Glock bringing lawsuits against these people, they're being attacked by in a lawsuit orchestrated through, I will say the word, a conspiracy between the White House and Everytown and the city of Chicago to attack Glock and try to blame them for this criminal conduct. It is ridiculous. And Congress needs to investigate this illegal conspiracy by Rob Wilcox, the White House, Everytown, and the city of Chicago. And I hope Glock considers filing a conspiracy lawsuit against the White House, naming Wilcox, naming Ms. Feldman, who runs the office, and Everytown, including Mr. Feinblatt, or Feinberg, whatever his name is.
Feinblatt, yeah, John Feinblatt. I hope that happens too. And I'm curious, and I'm a little concerned that that this is the opening salvo, right? That it doesn't stop here. That and you and I have talked about this before, Larry. You know, for years now, the gun control lobby has tried to advance this argument that, well, some or all semi-automatic firearms should be treated as if they're machine guns because they can be quote unquote readily converted, right? They've made this argument in civil litigation. They've made this argument to the ATF. How concerned are you that we're going to see and would this even require a rule from the ATF, or would this just be a reclassification? Is this something the ATF, if Joe Biden pressured them, could the ATF just suddenly decide to reclassify all Glock handguns or all semi-automatic handguns or all semi-automatic firearms as machine guns without a formal rule change?
It's possible, yes. And I don't know that the White House would have to twist any arms, maybe a pinky. But we've seen this argument advanced by Brady and others that, for example, modern sporting rifles are actually machine guns all along because someone can illegally convert it to function as a fully automatic firearm illegally. Now, ATF has resisted that in the past. In a recent decision, a federal court poo-pooed that idea entirely and said they're not machine guns at all. And that's not what the statute says. They have to be readily restored, not readily converted. That is the fallacy of misreading. And ATF is complicit in this, misreading the statute to suggest that, something that is not a frame receiver is somehow a frame or a receiver because it's readily convertible. That's not how the statute reads. That's, the readily convertible applies to, if you had all the parts assembled in a bag that you could reassemble them. But a frame or receiver is either a frame or receiver or it is not. But there's the law does not say readily convertible to a frame or receiver. That's not what the law says. And NSSF argued that position in our comment on the frame or receiver rule. So but now it's called the ghost gun rule. Mm-hmm. But we have seen ATF change its position on longstanding interpretations time and time again without rule. They or sometimes they do rules, but we have seen this time and time again where ATF. And we filed amicus briefs with the Supreme Court on this issue, where they change their mind, pull the rug out from underneath people, bump stocks, pistol braces, framer, what constitutes a framer receiver, after arguing in federal court in lawsuits filed by Giffords and Everytown, in federal court in San Francisco and in New York City, that, what constitutes or when they consider something to be a frame or a receiver, that they've completely redrawn the line, after themselves using the term 80% receiver, which they deny, but there it is on their website where they refer to it colloquially as an 80% receiver. So now I guess you can have a 79% receiver. I don't know, but I mean, where's the line where something, magically passes from being a block of metal to a frame or receiver? It's I've joked, UATF rule is a little bit like that famous line from the Supreme Court about pornography. Can't define it, but I know it when I see it. Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's very troubling to industry that ATF will just simply change its mind after, you know, decades in some cases of an interpretation of statute. The words of the statute don't change. It just becomes politically expedient to change their interpretation and pull the rug out from underneath, companies that relied upon what their government told them to build a business. And then they just pull the rug out from underneath.
And listen, it would be the nuclear option if they did that with Glock, if they did that with semi-automatic handguns or with even semi-automatic long guns. I mean, that would be, unprecedented doesn't even describe it. Again, it would be the nuclear option, right? You would be, in fact, imposing a sweeping gun ban without a vote of Congress. I'm not convinced that Biden's going to do it, but you're saying that it is within the realm of possibility here.
Unfortunately, it is. I agree with you. I think it's probably not likely they do it, because that is then for them to admit that they've allowed the industry to sell machine guns. Like, and they stood by and like, you know, that's the implication of that policy change. I mean, it's sort of true of bump stocks. They said no. And then all of a sudden, oh yeah, actually they are machine guns. Even though, you know, it's still very clear that the trigger has to function. You know, it's not functioned once and continues to fire. It may happen rapidly, but it still happens. The trigger has to go back and forth and reset, right?
Right.
There's nothing in the statute that talks about, you know, how quickly. It doesn't say, you know, anything like that. So, I mean, we saw the oral argument and the court struggled with, you know, the language. I mean, function of the trigger, the statute focuses on the object, trigger, not on, you know, pull of the trigger or whether you're actually pulling the trigger. It's the function of the trigger. And it's undeniable that your trigger functions repeatedly, maybe quickly, but it functions repeatedly. And as other courts have said, it's up to Congress to change the law, not ATF, and not, frankly, for the courts to, you know, interpret or to create a rule of law that criminalizes conduct that had heretofore been lawful and sanctioned, frankly, by the ATF.
Yeah, but as you say, I mean, listen, the abuses of language, the torturous language that they've used, to make these words all of a sudden now the function of a trigger is about the function of the user of the firearm or what the user of the firearm is doing. That is what concerns me about this, that, you know, and I don't think that it would be, you know, the Democrats' reputational risk that they'd be worried about that would keep this in check. I think they'd be more worried about the reaction from the response from gun owners. Right. If they were to do this before the election, obviously this would energize Joe Biden's base, but this would energize Trump's base, too. In fact, this would probably get, you know, a lot of folks who may be reluctant to vote for Donald Trump to say, all right, you know what, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump because I'm keeping my rights intact. I mean, that's the type of thing that gets people off the fence and to the voting booth.
You're right. And it would, you know, doing that would turn tens of millions of Americans into felons overnight, far more than, you know, was the case with the brace. Tens of millions. But again, you know, we do have an election coming up, as you mentioned. And people need to get involved and engaged. And, you know, we really need to see Second Amendment advocates, gun owners, become single issue voters again, like they have been in the past. And they need to engage, not just, you know, obviously you got to get registered, you got to show up and you got to vote, but you need to help so that, you know, the resources are there to educate the public. Unfortunately, NRA is not in a position to bring those sorts of resources to bear in this upcoming election as they have in the past. And that's why NSSF has stepped up and formed a super PAC to try to help replace some of those resources. So I would urge all of your listeners to go to www.protectlibertypac.com. Protect Liberty PAC. NSSF.com and support the NSSF Super PAC so we can run, you know, what are called independent expenditures, political ads in key races to make sure that we restore a pro-gun majority to the Senate, that we expand the razor-thin pro-gun majority in the House, razor-thin, and that we retire Joe Biden and send him to the dog track, as Don Imus used to say. So again, I whatever you can, your listeners can do, $1, $10, $17.76, you know, $20.24, $47 for the next president. Every single penny will help to replace the resources that NRA cannot bring to bear in this election because of their ongoing challenges, which, let's admit, are largely self-inflicted. Nevertheless, you know, the Second Amendment is not just about the NRA, right? I mean, it is about all of us, all Americans. We cherish our freedoms, our liberties, and this is the most hostile anti-gun industry or administration in the history of America. Far worse than anything Obama did, far, far worse than anything Clinton did. This is a whole of government attack against our Second Amendment rights.
Absolutely.
I mean, look at what's going on with the Treasury Department, snooping into what you're buying using your credit card. A conspiracy between the White House, every town in the city of Chicago to try to destroy Glock and to ruin them financially. The people need to really, honest to goodness, wake up, please get engaged, go to protectlibertypac.com and help us to help you.
Absolutely. And, you know, you brought up the Clinton administration, you know, comparing this to the Biden administration. Look, and certainly the Clinton administration was no friend to gun owners, right? In fact, it was during the Clinton administration that we really saw this partnership between the White House and the gun control lobby in terms of litigation, right? In terms of suing gun companies, really take off. And for almost 25 years, Larry, there has been this lawsuit floating around. It's amazing to me. 25 years. The city of Gary, Indiana's lawsuit against Smith & Wesson and other gun makers has been ongoing. This year, the Indiana legislature passed a bill signed by Governor Holcomb that will hopefully put a stop to this, right? Basically, it's lawsuit preemption. It's not the state legislature saying, you know, localities can't pass their own gun laws. It's the state legislature saying, listen, localities can't sue gun makers. This is the job of the Attorney General of Indiana. And so the Indiana Attorney General is the body that will pursue these types of lawsuits. And hopefully this puts a stop to the city of Gary's, again, decades long junk lawsuit against these gun makers. Why was this bill necessary? And I know that there's already been a request to dismiss this lawsuit. Do you think that request will be granted? Do you think that this new law is going to be litigated going forward?
Well, first, you're exactly right. Under the Clinton administration, they helped lead an effort that started literally on Halloween Day, 1998, when the city of New Orleans filed a lawsuit against major manufacturers in the United States. And then there were about 40 some odd lawsuits filed following that. It was orchestrated between the Brady, called Brady United Now back then. It was Handgun Control, Inc., and then the Brady Center was one part of this unholy alliance. The other were, you know, major Democrat-run cities, with the exception of New York, which was Rudy Giuliani, so-called Republican, who sued the industry, and plaintiffs' lawyers, ambulance chasers, who bet wrong in the tobacco litigation in the 90s and didn't see a payday from that big, massive settlement. They all got together, worked with the White House, Rahm Emanuel, right? Andrew Cuomo, disgraced Governor Andrew Cuomo, who was the HUD secretary, and they brought these lawsuits. All of them, but the City of Gary lawsuit, have been disposed of. Some were dismissed by the courts because they were frivolous. Some were dismissed because state laws were passed around the country that said, you know, you can't sue for these public nuisance theories, gun manufacturers, or reserved to the state the authority to bring an action, not local municipalities. Several cases were dismissed based on those statutes, Detroit, Wayne County, and several others. Some were just simply abandoned by the cities like Boston, Cincinnati, Camden, and others. But the Gary case, bizarrely, was allowed to continue because bad, totally incorrect decisions by the Indiana appellate courts that said that the city of Gary's public nuisance lawsuit fit within the predicate exception to the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, an absurd proposition, because it was these very city public nuisance lawsuits that were what's, you know, led to the passage of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. So to say that that case fit within the exception when the statute was unquestionably aimed at exactly lawsuits like Gary. And then there was a state statute that was passed, but it didn't apply retroactively. It was amended in 2015. But then the Indiana court said, no. The case can still go forward, we think, incorrectly. And what really led to the new law that was, you know, advocated for by NSSF and all of the Second Amendment groups came about because the court in the Gary case told retailers like Bass Pro Shops and Cabela's and others to turn over to the lawyers from Brady United that are representing Gary hundreds of thousands of 4473s of lawful purchases of dealers' A&D records going back 20 plus years. And that was sort of the last straw, where the legislature said, this has been going on for almost 25 years. The lawsuit was filed in August 1999. And they finally passed the law, which, by the way, was modeled on other statutes that were passed back in the, you know, 99 to 2001 timeframe that I just mentioned that led to cases being dismissed. It was literally verbatim to those other statutes, which were litigated by Brady at the time, by the way, and they lost and the cases were dismissed. So yes, on Monday, the defendants in the case filed a motion to have the case dismissed. It was called a motion for judgment on the pleadings, invoking the statute that divests the city of Gary from having legal standing to file to maintain the action. So I am hopeful that the case will be dismissed. It should be dismissed, although no doubt if it is dismissed, Gary will appeal and it'll go to the Indiana appellate courts again. And, you know, I'm hopeful that it's the end of the case. It should be the end of the case. Brady's lawyers, in opposing the bill, admitted and acknowledged that this would be the end of their case, but I'm sure they will change their tune in opposing the motion. So I'm hopeful, but, you know, past experience with the Indiana appellate courts, you know, causes me deep concern. At some point, we would love to see the Supreme Court have, you know, take the Gary case if necessary and say that Indiana appellate courts was wrong all those years ago, and this case should have been dismissed, you know, over a decade ago, like 2006, you know, because of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, should have ended this case back then. But hopefully it's the end of this, you know, quarter century nightmare, and it will be the final nail in the final coffin of these junk lawsuits filed by Brady and, you know, big cities trying to blame the industry for the actions of criminals. But, you know, Chicago was one of those cities that sued. And here we are, Chicago, 25 years later, trying to blame Glock for the actions of criminals. You know, they just changed their theories. They will never stop, which again is why, you know, we need to have pro-gun legislatures to help put a stop to this. And you guys that are listening, help us do that by going to Protect Liberty PAC and chipping in whatever you can. $100, I mean, you know, whatever. Every single penny will help.
Larry Keene, listen, I cannot thank you enough for joining me on the program today. We're going to be talking much more in the weeks and months to come here. But again, protectlibertypac.com. That's where folks can go to donate. Are you going to be focusing on any particular races? Are you going to be paying more attention to the down ticket races? Are you going to be putting, you know, more of your eggs in the presidential basket? Have you figured that out yet?
We're going to, you know, we're working on that right now. We have a voter registration, education, and, you know, mobilization effort we do called Gun Vote. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at that now. I mean, look, it's, you don't have to be a political guru to figure out, you know, what the competitive states are that are going to decide who wins the election, who wins the White House, who wins the Senate. You know, Arizona, Nevada, Montana, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Georgia, North Carolina. I mean, that's the universe, folks.
Yeah.
You know, but again, even if you don't live in one of those states, you still have to show up. You don't take anything for granted, right? And particularly if you live in those so-called battleground states, it's absolutely critical. You have to get registered. You have to show up and vote, you know, and you have to help. Please help. ProtectLibertyPAC.com. You know, it's so important. We have to have the resources to fight this battle. And, you know, those resources are not going to be there from NRA. It's just a simple reality.
Yeah.
You know, and we're just trying to help find a way to replace those resources. In addition to what NSSF is going to spend directly, you know, we need to help try to fill that void.
Absolutely. Larry Keene, thank you so much for your time today. Always good talking with you. And we'll see how the Yankees and the Red Sox do this year.
You know, yeah. Season started yesterday, today.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in South Korea, like, that's where the first game is.
Yeah, I know. Well, maybe this will be the year you and I actually go take in a Red Sox-Yankees game. We've talked about it for, 20 years now almost. We have yet to do it. So maybe this will be the season.
Deal. Deal. Right. Even if they suck, let's go.
All right. That sounds good. Larry, thanks so much, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Pleasure to be with you. Thanks, buddy.
My thanks to Larry for joining us on the program today. And we will, of course, be watching very closely what's going on in Chicago versus Glock, as well as any potential action coming out of the ATF regarding semi-automatic firearms in the readily converted language. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a story out of Boston. Criminal history of the man accused of shooting a Boston cop includes a recent dropped case, as well as a federal probe. Now, again, that is just a couple of the incidents in this suspect's past. Avery Lewis, 31-year-old man, accused of shooting a Boston police officer during a domestic incident. Thankfully, that officer did not lose his life. Has a criminal history dating back 14 years, according to Boston 25. Lewis was arraigned Tuesday in Dorchester District Court on a dozen charges relating to the shooting on Monday night, where investigators say a child, who was Avery's child, staying with his mother's new boyfriend, apparently again a domestic dispute ensued. Lewis is accused of shooting a Boston police officer who's wearing, thankfully, a bullet-resistant vest and was not seriously injured in that attack. Larry Calderon, president of the Boston Patrolman's Association, says to see that officer smiling and talking to people just makes you feel great. This should never be accepted, and it should be punished to the fullest extent of the law. Now, Boston 25 reports that Lewis has been in and out of jail multiple times since 2009 when he was arrested for armed robbery. He was also charged with trafficking more than 200 grams of cocaine last year. He pleaded not guilty in that case, was released on a $10,000 bail. Norfolk County District Attorney Michael Morrissey ended up dropping that case last August, saying that it was connected to a federal investigation. But the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston isn't saying anything about whether or not Lewis is the subject of any current probes. Court records do note, however, that Lewis had several other cases at the state level, including drug charges in Webster and Dudley, Massachusetts in 2017. He was also arrested for allegedly selling drugs near the Community Academy of Science and Health in Dorchester in 2017. That case was dismissed. In the other cases from 2017, he pled guilty in Worcester Superior Court in 2019 to selling cocaine was placed on probation, apparently, completed that probation last June. So again, lots of run-ins with the law. We don't know how much time Lewis spent behind bars for that armed robbery charge back in 2009, but clearly it wasn't a whole lot of time because he was arrested not long afterwards and has been in trouble with the law off and on ever since. And again, sounds like in every one of these cases, slaps on the wrist rather than a stiff sentence delivered. Today's Armed Citizen story, Trenton, New Jersey, where police say a man was shot and killed by a homeowner after allegedly breaking into a home while armed with a hammer. Yeah. This was in Trenton about 10:25 Sunday night. That's when officers got a call about a shooting in the area. Detectives who were on an unrelated assignment found a man on St. Francis Avenue who had a gunshot wound to the chest, identified as 34-year-old Andre Ingram, taken to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead. During the investigation, 6ABC in Philadelphia reports that police determined that a homeowner had fired multiple shots at an unknown individual who was armed with a hammer, had bashed this guy's Ring doorbell camera, and was then banging on the homeowner's front door. At one point, that individual, later identified as Ingram, managed to get inside the vestibule of the home. And that is when the homeowner drew their firearm. Shots were fired. Ingram was hit. He ran outside the residence and then collapsed again a short time away. Police say that they are still investigating, but no charges have been filed. And even in New Jersey, you do have a right to act in self-defense. Although, given that this is New Jersey, there's also the distinct possibility that you'll be prosecuted for acting in self-defense, even in your home. So we will be keeping an eye on this case and bringing you any more details as they become available. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, wasn't able to do the right thing. A 15-year-old boy from Detroit who used CPR to save his neighbor's life. CPR, by the way, not learned at the, you know, YMCA, not learned at school. Nope. Gregory Pope III says he learned CPR from watching Grey's Anatomy. I had no idea. First of all, I had no idea that 15-year-olds were watching Grey's Anatomy. Second of all, I had no idea that you could learn CPR from watching Grey's Anatomy. But good for Gregory Pope III. He says, it feels great. I was just trying to keep doing what I do. He said, I felt like I had to do something because nobody really knew how to do it. So I just stepped in, knowing what I know. I just know what I did. And again, this neighbor who had stopped breathing is now alive and well today because of Gregory Pope III. He was, again, honored this week in Detroit, getting a life-saving award, his family on hand for that award ceremony. You can see Gregory there in the bright red, bright pink pants, I don't know, and a very proud family standing beside him. Again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. By the way, Gregory Pope III says he plans on going to the NFL when he gets older. Good for him. But he does have a backup plan of going into the medical field. Never would I discourage a kid from pursuing their dreams, but it is good to hear that he has a backup plan just in case the NFL doesn't work out. Because, you know, that's a difficult field to break into. But Gregory Pope III, again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing because of the knowledge imparted from Grey's Anatomy. There you go. Today's good deed of the day. That's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to being back with you again tomorrow. But in the meantime, don't forget to check out BearingArms.com. We're keeping you updated on all of the major Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. But a lot of court cases, a lot of legal stuff going on this week. And again, we're covering it all for you, as well as defensive gun uses, latest legislative news, Colorado holding a marathon hearing on a gun ban bill on Tuesday night into Wednesday morning. All of those stories and more, you can find it at BearingArms.com. If you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member. Just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe and then use the promo code SAVEAMERICA for a substantial discount on your VIP or VIP Gold membership. We're going to give you exclusive content you won't find anywhere else because your support really does matter and it truly does make a difference. So thank you again. Enjoy the rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.